Good morning. This is Focus, our number two of the show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer. Kyle Mabry is at the controls for this hour. We have a health topic for you in this part of the show, something that we try to do at least once a year on the program. And we'll be talking about the back and care of the back. Some people have chronic problems. Some people just have occasional problems. But there are certainly things that you can do in the way that you live to try to minimize problems. And then maybe there are some things that we're going to take you to the doctor. We'll see if we can talk a little bit about all of that this morning in this hour with our guest, James Harms. He's an orthopedic surgeon at the Carl Spine Institute in Urbana, and he's been with us before many times to talk about the back and answer questions. And I always try, when we have a physician on the program here, to caution people about our ability to diagnose over the phone. There's only so much we can do because the doctor cannot see you. But, of course, we do these shows to try to help you and to add to your information and to give you at least a place to start where you can ask some basic questions. And that's what the program is all about. So people have questions about themselves or someone close to them, back-related issues, give us a call, and the doctor will see if he can help you out. 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send us an email, you can do that too, will-talk@illinois.edu. Thank you very much.
Good morning.
For being here. We certainly appreciate it once again. You know, whenever we would do this show, I guess I try to give you the opportunity to talk a little basic back stuff right at the beginning. And there's different ways I suppose we could approach that. Maybe one way I could say was, well, for people who have back trouble, and I don't mean occasional back trouble. I mean maybe more difficult back trouble. If you divide that into very broad categories, the part that's genetic and the part that's the way you live, lifestyle, how does each of those two things contribute?
Interesting question. From twin studies, we now know that about half of the reason that a person might have back pain would be on the basis of the genes they inherited from their parents, and about half is environmental. Obviously, you can't change who your parents are, so we concentrate on the environmental part of it. The major factors have to do with some of our lifestyles, including cigarette smoking, lack of exercise, and being more than 20% over ideal weight. In this day and age, it's very easy to be more than 20% over ideal weight, and so that's one of the big ones. We think cigarette smoking poisons the enzymes that keeps the water in the discs, and hence the discs will age more rapidly than usual. As a surgeon, I have to be cognizant of the fact that cigarette smoking interferes with spine fusions, and there's less chance of a good result in a cigarette smoker. Obviously, we've known about exercise being good for the human body through the years, but even more so, it's important for the lumbar spine. So that's kind of the quick and dirty on the genetic versus environmental factors.
And just to, here, I have a caller here I will get right to. Maybe just a quick kind of question about exercise. Are there particular kinds of exercise that are going to be more beneficial? What exactly is the thing that you're hoping to modify?
There really are three factors to exercise. The number one and probably the most important is cardiovascular fitness. People who get regular general exercise have happier backs on average. So a person that walks a couple miles a day, somebody that swims three times a week, someone that gets on their exercise bicycle for 45 minutes two or three times a week, those are the kind of general exercise that's most important. Now, if one can keep the abdominal and back muscles firm, that also is thought to help. In theory, if those muscles absorb more of the load, then less of the force would be transmitted down to any sensitive areas. We think flexibility plays a part in it also. Mm-hmm. But number one is cardiovascular fitness.
Okay. Well, we have a caller here. Why don't we talk to them? We won't make them wait. Someone on a cell phone, and they are on our line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Excellent lead-in. I was actually going to be asking something along these exact lines about exercise. I'm a cyclist, and I spent nearly 10 years as a competitive cyclist, And now I'm averaging about 15 hours a week on the bike. And when I was younger, I was involved in a car versus bike wreck, and I impacted my C2, C1, and I also cracked my L4, L5, and sacrum. And I've had lifetime issues since then, and I've done my best to try and keep up on the exercise so that I keep the muscles for my back and my stomach balanced. And I've had this ongoing conversation with cyclists. I don't know whether you have a background in sports medicine or not. And the question is really about balancing your two stomach muscles. And if you could talk to the importance of balancing muscles, and then if you were to follow up and suggest something that would be a good whole body type of strengthening. Like, for example, I do a lot of focus types of things. I've heard crunches really do nothing, but I do a lot of leg lifts and like Roman chair leg lifts, and also doing back extensions where you're laying down your stomach and doing both leg lifts that way and stomach and lifting your upper body. And I'd be more than happy to listen off air on your opinions. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you.
You're welcome. Obviously, if you've been involved in a motor vehicle incident, particularly when you're not in a vehicle, your spine absorbed a lot of stress. If it was bad enough to cause fractures, then we know the joints and the discs were also very, very likely affected. So you'd be more likely later in life to have complaints in the neck region from the neck injury and the low back from the low back injury. I got to tell you, though, that you're very sophisticated in terms of exercise, because you're already probably better than 99% of the American population. So the comments that I make will be for the general audience, and I'll try to steer you the right direction. But I got to warn you off bat, for a person who's already as sophisticated as you are, an exercise therapist or physiologist is probably going to be the best one to help individualize a program for you. The generalities that I can talk about today can't take into account any one individual's situation. Be that as it may, I think that your emphasis on keeping your muscles strong and balanced is quite appropriate. I think that any way that you can get that done that doesn't irritate your situation makes sense to me. You say that leg lifts and are not too bad, that crunches, you've heard, don't do too much. We can't get most of the people that we see to even do crunches, which may not be ideal, but helps some. So anything you can do to keep the abdominal and back muscles strong and balanced makes sense. Now, cyclists have an extra risk factor that I don't know you're aware of, and that is the pressure in the discs is lowest when reclining, intermediate when standing, and highest when sitting. Cyclists, as you know, are sitting for quite some time during their exercise periods, in fact, all of the time. So I think your heart and mind are in exactly the right place, but I would caution you that without seeing an exercise specialist, someone who's used to dealing with people in your situation, I probably can't give you the specific information that you need. Our area is blessed to have the University of Illinois, which has a number of people who specialize in sports medicine, physical therapy, as does Carl, big department at Carl. So I would recommend to you a visit with one of those, with a therapist somewhere in town. There's private ones also that can give you an individual evaluation.
Okay. Well, hope that helps. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. You may also send email to will-talk@illinois.edu. Our guest is Dr. Jim Harms. He's an orthopedic surgeon at the Carl Spine Institute, and we're talking about the back and care of the back. So if you have specific questions or maybe more general ones, you can give us a call. Just following up on the comment you made about the time when, if I heard this right, you're saying essentially the most stress on the back is when you are sitting. And given that probably most of us, particularly when we're working, are spending most of our time sitting, what can you say about things that people can do to try to relieve that stress?
Go to the drinking fountain often, take your breaks, and move around. Some people who have trouble sitting have even talked their employers into getting one of those standing workstations. So that's a possibility. The most enlightened businesses sometimes even put a computer workstation on a treadmill for people to walk while they're working. But in general, it's find a way to get exercise to compensate for all the time that you've been sitting if you can't move around much during the day.
Yeah, I think I would get them to put a treadmill in here so I can walk when I'm doing the show.
I'll be happy to write a note to your employer if you'd like.
Okay. Well, we can walk together. We have another caller here on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Thanks for taking my call. I've got specifics on my wife's situation, and then I had a quick question. She's in her mid-40s. She had a severe fall about 20 years ago. Actually, she has a herniated disc and two cracked vertebrae. The interesting thing about it is that she's a dance instructor, and if she's dancing or, as the doctor said, if she's laying down, she's perfectly fine. Where she really runs into a pickle is when she sits for any prolonged period of time. So it's funny to think about it, but she actually does quite well when she's jumping around and teaching her little ones dance. My question to you is... It appears then when she bends down, picks something up or some sort of sudden movement, then she's in a great deal of pain and it's prolonged. We're thinking that surgery is probably inevitable, but I'm just wondering if your guests could comment on, from what I heard about back surgery back in the day, it was kind of hit and miss. People had it, some people didn't have it, and really the results kind of almost, you know, on a case-by-case basis. I was wondering if he could speak as to back surgery, not knowing the specifics of the case, just from what I said, if he thought it was inevitable. And I'll go ahead and listen off air. Thanks.
Okay.
So we have a female who had an injury to the back 20 years ago when it was a fall. Two fractures were diagnosed, which again means that the spine absorbed a significant amount of energy, and that energy could have affected the health of the joints in the back or the discs in the back. The individual is better with activity and reclining and worse with sitting, and certain activities, particularly sudden bending, seems to aggravate the situation. It sounds to me like there is a problem with one or more of the discs in the lower back aging before their time, and you have to have that if the person's had a herniated disc. Remember, a herniated disc is a crack in the outer part of the disc called the annulus, and some of the center material that's like crab meat in consistency comes out and rubs on a nerve. So classically, one does not get back pain from a herniated disc. One gets leg pain, usually down the back or the side of the leg. Many people have a herniated disc and get over that, but they're left with bad back pain, and that may be what happened in this situation. The disc closed off the hole where the piece of disc came out of, and the body was good enough to remove that piece of disc, but one's left, this patient, presumably this lady, is left with a bad backache with certain activities. If a person has incapacitating back pain and it's a single disc that's aging before its time, then a spine fusion can be done. That means stopping the motion by putting in bone chips and getting the person's body to grow two bones into one solid piece. Unfortunately, it's often hard to tell where the pain's coming from. If there's more than one disc that looks abnormal, then it may be the second disc is causing a lot of the symptoms, or even a third. If a person had two fractures in the spine, that would suggest that the trauma may have been diffuse, and we don't do too well with doing spine fusions over long areas of the spine and getting a good result. It sounds like this lady is pretty smart, and she knows that if she stays active, exercise, does her dance, that she does much better. And like most of us, we don't like to sit for long periods of time. If we have any discs that are aging before their time, or if we have any arthritis in our back. Both of those can be irritated by sitting. So I would say that surgery is not inevitable because most people with discs aging before their time find that it can burn itself out with time. That is, as the disc narrows, we think certain chemicals are given off. If those chemicals go into the small nerves that go to the muscles of the back, that gives backache. If those chemicals go into the larger nerves that come out the back and go down the leg, that can give some leg pain, not as serious as if there's a herniated disc, but it can give some leg pain. And once the discs finish aging, once the bones reach their final resting spot, a lot of people, not everybody unfortunately, but a lot of people find they're tremendously better. So I would say to this young lady, stay the course, continue with the exercise, look for modifications of the chair, look for support to raise the feet up so that the back of the thighs are not caught on the corner, front corner of the chair. There are lots of things that can be done to help out. A physical medicine doctor who specializes in back problems, a physical therapist who teaches back school, even some of our chiropractors are very good at helping people in this situation.
Okay. Well, again, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Myself, I find when I have occasional back trouble, and I do that, that one of the things that seems to really help it a lot, actually, is walking. Which for me, that's my big form of exercise is walking. Which, and I wonder why is it that I'm vertical? Is it something about the motion that is good?
Well, we've already talked about sitting being a less than ideal position, and you do a lot of sitting in your job, as you chuckled about earlier today.
Yes,
we think that regular exercise helps people in a number of ways. Walking has two good ways of helping. First of all, exercise stimulates the endorphins in the brain, and that's the body's natural morphine, if you will, and tends to suppress pain signals. The other way that it is theorized, this is not absolute truth now, this is theorized that walking helps, is that the pumping action by the gentle up and down motion causes the discs to suck in more nutrients, oxygen, and water during the that form of exercise. So remember that the astronauts, when they are up in space and come back after a while, are taller than they were. It's because the discs, without gravity, imbibe more water, suck in more water. And that may happen to a small extent while you're walking, because you on the upswing or on the downswing, there's less gravity on you.
Well, I guess that prompts a question about hydration, particularly in the summertime. If you're not paying attention to your hydration, can that actually affect your back?
Not that we know of. The body will find ways of protecting certain structures and keeping the water there. So certainly not at the level that one of us would get dehydrated by working outside on a hot day.
Okay. Other callers. Next, someone in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Are you familiar with a person by the name, a man by the name of Robin McKenzie, who has a book that he calls Seven Steps to a Pain-Free Life, and dealing with the back and different exercises to do to maintain your vertebrae in alignment?
Yes, indeed. McKenzie is from Down Under, and he's quite famous for his directional method of treating back problems. In fact, that's the major emphasis we do at the place I work with physical therapy. If you come in with a back problem and there's not any high risk of neurologic injury by non-operative treatment, I will suggest that the person see one of our therapists who specializes in McKenzie-based pain relief exercises. You go to the therapist. The therapist asks you a few questions, pokes on you, and then tests you out to see if a motion can be found to make your pain worse. The therapist then teaches you how to do the opposite motion 5 times a day for 2 minutes, and oftentimes that has a dramatic relieving effect on the pain. Our therapists claim a 60 to 80% chance of helping patients with back pain, leg pain, arm pain, and even sometimes headaches.
Well, excellent. Well, thank you. You've been most helpful.
All right.
That was an easy one.
Let's go here to somebody else. Line number two in Urbana. Hello.
Hi. I had very bad back pain for a number of years, and eventually I persuaded Dr. Harms to do surgery, which did help. But I noticed something afterwards. I was helping my brother at that time do a lot of mowing and riding lawnmower for several hours at nights and on weekends. And that seemed to be that jiggling motion, even though I was in the sitting position, really seemed to be very helpful. Can you explain that?
No. give me just a second here, though. In general, it is thought that people that spend more than a certain amount of time, I think it's more than 3 hours a day in a vehicle, are more prone to back problems. And the cycles or the vibration frequency seems to have an effect on that. If that's correct, then maybe certain other frequencies of vibration might be helpful. Now, that's speculation. It may well be that getting out in the fresh air, it may be that getting away from your stressful job, it may be that walking to the tractor. There are all sorts of variables here, and I can't tell you scientifically what's happening.
Purely anecdotal, but I thought I'd add it to your repertoire.
And I will mention that to other patients that they ought to take over mowing the lawn from their spouse and see what happens.
Thanks.
All right, thank you. Well, that certainly does suggest that it must be that people who do people who are professional drivers, I suppose, bus drivers, truck drivers, even people who spend a lot of time in the car, that could well be problematic.
It's an occupational hazard, and I believe that if a person will find a way to exercise, that can go a long ways towards counteracting the negative effects.
All right. Let's see. Well, we have another caller here. This is Urbana, and line number one. Hello.
Hi. I have a question about a condition I cannot pronounce. It's called bamboo spine or ankylosing. Is that how you pronounce that?
Very close. The layman's term would be bamboo spine, and that's the nickname. The name that we give it medically is ankylosing spondylitis. Does that sound right?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
I have a nephew who was recently diagnosed with this condition, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about it. I understand there's a genetic component to this, and I'm wondering if you can talk about the genetic factors involved.
Yes. For the rest of the audience, there are ligaments that go along the side of the spine that provide stability. The disc in the front allows some motion. The joints in the back of the spine allow some motion. And that's how we bend forwards and backwards, side to side, and how we twist. There's a genetic condition called ankylosing spondylitis that's inherited, and the gene has been found that's associated with this problem. It's called HLA-B27. And if you have that genetic marker, your risk of getting the stiffening of the spine goes up tremendously. It usually appears in adolescent males in their late adolescence or early 20s, although it can happen to females. It starts out usually with vague pain in the pelvic region, the lower back. The spine stiffens, usually starting in the chest region, going to the lower spine, sometimes even into the neck. Occasionally, it can go into the hips, and the hips can grow together into one solid piece so they don't move. There is often x-ray findings at the sacroiliac joint as the first marker of the changes in the spine. One of the tests that we do clinically to see if a person might have ankylosing spondylitis is take a tape measure and put it around the chest and see how big a breath a person can take. If the chest expansion is low, that may mean that the ankylosing spondylitis is affecting the joints between the spine and the ribs and not allowing the normal chest expansion. The treatment for this is generally education, exercise to try to maintain whatever flexibility is present, and if a person is in pain, then the anti-inflammatory or arthritis medications can help. The situation is usually painful while the stiffening of the spine is taking place, but then becomes much less painful once the bones grow together.
Would you recommend any sort of testing to see if relatives have this particular gene?
I don't know what the genetics people are recommending at the present time. Mm-hmm. Currently, there is no reason. There's nothing that can be done to prevent the onset of the disease if you have the genetic marker, and not everybody with the genetic marker gets it. Usually, screening procedures are helpful if it will change your behavior based on the result of the screening procedure.
What percentage of people who have the genetic marker actually develop this condition?
Gosh, I haven't had to know that number for a long time. I can't tell you right now.
Can you give me a ballpark figure?
Of the people that have the HLA-B27, probably 20% would get the ankylosing spondylitis. Mm-hmm. And if you have ankylosing spondylitis, I think you 95% of the time will have the HLA-B27 marker.
Okay.
Ballpark.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much. Our guest in this hour of focus is Dr. James Harms. He's an orthopedic surgeon with the Carl Spine Institute, and we're talking about the back and care of the back, and certainly questions are welcome. We have a couple here. Maybe I can do them fairly quickly, or at least one of them. They have come in by email. Someone would like to know what you think of inversion devices and the benefits, if any, of decompression.
Yes. Inversion is a formalized way of traction. Basically, one anchors one's legs or pelvis and turns upside down to a certain degree, and gravity then pulls the rest of the body. That puts traction on the discs and helps, in theory, the discs imbibe a little more water, if you will, get a little more nutrition, etc. There's a certain percentage of the population that's helps quite a bit. Unfortunately, it's fairly low. It's certainly below 10% and probably below 5%. Mm-hmm. Probably an additional 25% of people or so, maybe a little more, will get temporary help. That is, the inversion will help for minutes or hours, but usually not weeks or months. So I have no objection if a person tries that. I'm just not very optimistic that the person will find it helpful as a longer-term option.
Yeah, I would think that actually a lot of people would find it very uncomfortable, but perhaps something that you would get used to. If what you were talking about literally is hanging upside down.
No, it's not quite that. It's on an angle.
Oh, okay.
So if you hang upside down, all the blood rushes to your head, as it's anecdotally said, and you tend to faint, and other bad things tend to happen to your heart, etc.
Okay. So you can get the same effect by having the person actually hanging upside down.
Correct.
It's putting them on some sort of a slanting table or
yes.
something.
There are also computerized traction devices that have come and gone over the years. Most of them, in fact, none of them that I know of are covered by insurance. But every once in a while, we get somebody who's dramatically helped by them. So with all the inversion and traction devices, it's a device that temporarily helps some people, and there's nothing wrong with trying it.
All right. We are talking this morning about the care of the back. Our guest is Dr. James Harms. He's an orthopedic surgeon, and we will talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, heirloom tomatoes, artisan bread, and a whole new way to think about food. We'll talk with Alice Waters, the matriarch of locally sourced sustainable cuisine. She inspired an entire generation of chefs and home cooks, and her new memoir documents 40 years at her restaurant, Chez Panisse. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible by the Friends of WILL and by The Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta, located in Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, and we have 10 different topics for you every week. Tomorrow morning on the show, we'll be talking about nuclear energy. Our guest will be James Stubbins. He is the department head of nuclear plasma and radiological engineering. And we'll talk about nuclear generation of electricity. He certainly is somebody who thinks that that's a good thing, and we'll be making the case for it. We'll talk about plant design and the issue of waste disposal, and sometime very soon on the program also, because everyone does not see the issue the same. We'll also have someone who will outline why he thinks that nuclear energy is not a good thing. Also tomorrow, then, we'll go from fission to fusion, and we'll be talking about the sun in the second hour. Bob Berman will be the guest. He is a writer and has authored a book that's titled The Sun's Heartbeat and Other Stories from the Life of the Star That Powers Our Planet. Also, I want to remind you that tomorrow night on WILL-TV, also AM and online, I'll be sitting down for another conversation with the president of the University of Illinois, Michael Hogan. He's been on the job a little bit more than a year. We'll talk about some of the challenges of his first year, and certainly there has been quite a bit of news in the last couple of months. It is a live show, and we will be taking calls in advance. If you'd like, you can submit a question to our email site, will-talk@illinois.edu. But, of course, we will be taking calls tomorrow night. So that's tomorrow, 9 o'clock in the evening on WILL-TV, AM, and online. In this hour, the guest of the program is Dr. James Harms. He's an orthopedic surgeon at the Carl Spine Institute. And if you have questions about the back, back problems, give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I do have here another item that has come in by email from someone who wants to know, to what extent does being overweight cause a forward stooped posture, and what benefits derive from better posture?
Interesting question. We think that a person who's more than 20% over ideal weight has a higher incidence of back problems, and at least we think that the extra weight puts extra stresses on the discs and the joints in the back of the spine so that they tend to age more rapidly than usual. 80% of the people I do surgery on are cigarette smokers, overweight, or both. So I know from my own personal experience that this is true. The stooping of the back or forward bend is not necessarily associated with an increase in weight. So there may be two independent problems. As we get older, we do lose some of the water from our discs, and that does tend to bend us a little more forward. As we get older, if we get osteoporosis, particularly thin white females, there can be osteoporotic or lack of calcium in the bone fractures, and that can bend us forward some. As we get older, our muscles get a little bit weaker, and that can add to poor posture. Any extra forward bend puts more stress on the discs and joints, and the muscles that are expected to hold us upright have to do extra work and can fatigue more easily. So if a person has a problem with bending forward and overweight, a good place to start is with the primary care doctor and look at causes for the weight gain. The primary care doctor can look at a person's posture and then maybe suggest physical therapy, exercises, occasionally bracing. If the primary care doctor is uncomfortable, then a spine specialist can be consulted. Normally, that would be a physical medicine doctor. A lot of our chiropractors in our area are very big into overall wellness programs that include such problems as being overweight and posture. So people in our area have a lot of opportunities for help with a situation such as this. As in your disclaimer at the beginning of the program, David, this is something that would be really hard to diagnose and to give specific information over the phone. So I think some attention by the primary care doctor is a good place to start.
All right. Let's talk about beds. That was one of the things that I know that you came thinking that might be, you might want to say a couple of things about it. Are there things that either about one's bed that can either help with back problems or perhaps make them worse?
Absolutely. In the old days, going by anecdotal evidence, I told people that 2/3 of the patients were better on a firm mattress, 1/3 were better on a waterbed, and a fraction of 1% were better on a soft mattress. That was the traditionally held truth, without a lot of experimental or data to back it up. More recently, maybe 5 years ago, there was an article that came out of one of the Scandinavian countries, and after reading that, I learned that beds are rated for their firmness on a 1 to 10 point scale, and 70% of individuals have happier backs if they're on a 5 to 7 firmness mattress. Now, in this day and age, a lot of people like those pillow top covers or buy a pillow top mattress. Unfortunately, all I can do is tell you statistically what's most likely to be good. But for any one person, they need to check out a mattress, either visit a friend or sleep in their kids' mattress, or go to the mattress store and bring a book and lie on the mattress for a little while, because it's highly individualistic. But in general, 5 to 7 on a 10-point scale is thought to be best for most people.
Mm-hmm. What about sleeping position? I think that maybe we've talked about this in the past, that perhaps sleeping in certain positions, like on your stomach, for example, it's thought not to be good. Although, you know, perhaps there are some people that will actually feel more comfortable or will feel comfortable sleeping on their stomachs.
Absolutely true. The most comfortable position for a person who has a back problem, be it minor or severe, is on that person's back with two pillows beneath the knees, so the hips and knees are flexed. The equivalent position of lying on one side with hips and knees flexed is equally good, but oftentimes one needs a pillow between one's knees for the comfort. Sleeping on the stomach for most people with a back problem makes their symptoms worse, although I get an occasional person who says, that's the only way I can sleep.
We have some other callers here coming in. And by the way, if you have questions for our guest, give us a call, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And we have another Urbana listener here on our line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Dr. Harms, I saw you in January 2010, and you said at that time I probably would need surgery within the next year. Well, I haven't had surgery, but I notice in my right foot and a little bit of the leg, I'm getting some tingling, but I don't have any back pain. What should I do?
Well, if I told you that I thought you'd be back in a year for surgery, and it's been a year and a half, congratulations. You must be one tough character.
I'm taking the McKinsey exercises.
Okay. I don't usually make that prediction unless somebody has a really ugly X-ray or MRI. So you've got a high pain tolerance. I'm not going to go home and tell my wife that I was wrong again, though, if you don't mind. The tingling that you've got in the foot, given the fact that you have a bad back, means that the nerve that goes to that area is being irritated by a spur and it's being rubbed on. So the correct signals are not getting from the foot up to the brain and from the brain down to the foot. So that's causing your tingling. If that's all you've got and you can live with it, keep up with your McKinsey-based exercises. If it gets to be severe enough so that you don't want to live with it, then you'd be a candidate to remove the spurs to give the nerves more room.
Okay.
But you got to be a tough lady.
I'm just concerned about it might go numb. It's just tingling now. Is that the future?
Yeah, possibly. Unfortunately, I cannot see the future very well. But the patterns usually are such that once a person starts getting this problem, it gradually gets worse over many months or years. Any symptoms that come and go before surgery can generally be helped tremendously by surgery. Any symptoms that come and stay generally are not as well helped by surgery. By that I mean pain usually gets better with surgery, but weakness and numbness is much more variable in terms of its response to an operation. So if you just got tingling that comes and goes, I'm not too worried about that. If you get numbness that's starting to come and not go away, then yes, you might want to have another visit.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Very good. Thank you. And we'll continue. The next caller is also in Urbana. This is line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah?
I have a question about osteopathic physicians. And I have always preferred going to osteopaths because typically in my experience, they have been able to do some of the same manipulations that chiropractors do. And for me, it's been kind of one-stop shopping. But I had a relationship with a physician, well, an osteopath, through Carl that left the community a few years ago. And he was saying that there are fewer and fewer osteopaths that do the manipulations, the physical manipulations. And is that true, or Do you find that there are any osteopaths at Carl that do that? I know you can't recommend specific physicians, but...
Yes, indeed. Osteopaths in the past had what MDs thought of as an inferior education, and they were ostracized, and Carl didn't have any osteopaths for quite some time. The times have changed tremendously, and osteopaths go through an education that's equivalent to the medical school, and MDs and DOs actually go to some of the same residencies for training. So the medical back differences, the medical background now, it can be negligible. Doesn't have to be, but usually is negligible. Osteopaths are trained in manual medicine techniques on the same level. Well, I better be careful how I phrase this. Osteopaths and chiropractors are both trained in manual medicine techniques. And when I tell patients that they can, if they ask me, can I get manual medicine, can I get somebody to crack my back, I say, yeah, you can go to an osteopath or a chiropractor, and it's your choice. So I think that that does help a lot of people. The institution I work for, Carl, does have a large number of osteopaths, and I would agree with you that percentage-wise, a smaller number are doing manual medicine techniques. We actually had one working in orthopedics doing spine manipulation for a while until he left to go elsewhere. But there are at least two I know of osteopaths at Carl who still do manual medicine work. And you could call up and ask in the family medicine department who still does it and the locations and find yourself someone that may be quite helpful.
That would be great. Thank you very much.
Right, you're welcome.
Thank you. And again, to another caller, and this is someone in Champaign, this time line number three. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Nice to hear Dr. Harms again with that lovely booming voice. Just a quick question or two here. Briefly, I've been diagnosed with inflammatory arthritis and have had three hip joint replacements. There are issues now in the shoulders, and Dr. Harms diagnosed degenerative disc disease 15 years ago. A lot of bony spurs growing in the spine and shoulders. And I'm wondering how these bony spurs affect what continues to happen in the spine and in the shoulder. Two of the spinal discs have spontaneously fused, and I just need some additional information. I'm going to hang up and thank Dr. Harms and you, David. Bye-bye now.
Okay, well, there you go.
It's unfortunate that you've probably inherited the genes for your joints to age more rapidly than usual. And that often is an inflammatory process where the synovial membranes, the synovial tissue, which lines the joints and produces joint fluid, goes down the wrong path. This can happen in any joints in the body, and the major joints, such as shoulders and hips, are often affected. I get into the picture when a person has an ugly low back and they have hip pain, and is it coming from the hip or the back? Same goes for the shoulder. Sometimes it's hard to tell what's coming from the shoulders and what's coming from the cervical spine or neck. In general, in the spine, spurs that grow out don't cause any problems whatsoever. The muscles don't mind having a spur nearby or rubbing on them at all. The problem is when the spurs grow into the spinal canal, and that can then rub on a nerve or the spinal cord in the case of the neck. Obviously, the nerves in the spinal cord don't like that at all, and one can get pain, weakness, numbness, balance problems, difficulty controlling bowels or bladder, any of those things. Some people just get some mild ingrowth of spurs and don't get any symptoms whatsoever. So the fact that you have spurs doesn't mean that you will require surgery. The inflammatory types of arthritis, such as ankylosing spondylitis, not that you have that type, but that's another example that the earlier caller gave us. With any of those inflammatory arthritides, one can get calcium deposition in the ligaments along the spine, and that's a signal for the body to turn that tissue, in this case a ligament, into bone. As it turns to bone, there is fusion of the spine at that level. When there's fusion of the spine, generally that segment of the spine becomes painless. so it's not necessarily a bad thing from a pain point of view. Unfortunately, if one area fuses, that might concentrate the forces at the level above and level below and accelerate the rate at which that disc ages. So in your case, anti-inflammatory medications, if your stomach can handle it, your medical doctor blesses it, exercise to maintain your motion, those are the kind of things that could be helpful in the long run.
Here's an interesting question. It's coming by email from someone who writes, I've been practicing yoga for about 10 years. Recently, I went for my annual exam, and I was told that I measured 1 inch taller. I'm 58 years old, woman. Yoga claims to create healthier spine, especially through the poses that involve twists, which may bring greater nutrients and hydration to the discs. Would you attribute my change in height to my yoga practice? She says, I've been 5'3 all my life, and now I'm 5'4.
Well, I know a lot of people are going to take up yoga if that's correct. There's no doubt that exercise can have a positive effect on the spine. There is nothing in the spine literature to suggest that yoga will make people taller. It is possible that there would be some small differences, and in your case, it's possible that it did make the difference. However, the probability of it being generalized to the average person in the population is extremely low. It's most likely that an error was made in the measurement at some point. But the benefits of yoga are so great, whether you get taller or shorter, that I'm going to suggest that you keep it up. And that is a non-traumatic exercise form that helps an awful lot of people who have back complaints.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Line one again to Champagne. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question. Can psoas muscle that's acting up in the groin affect the flank and lower side and lower back of a person?
Yes, indeed it can. The psoas muscle, for anybody that's a butcher, you know that that's the tenderloin. And that goes from the lumbar spine, goes through the pelvis, and attaches at the lesser trochanter, which is a part of the bone on the inside of the hip area, the inside of the thigh area. It's responsible for bending the leg upward. That muscle can be affected by spinal conditions. One can get an inflammation or infection in that region that can give back pain and pelvic pain and groin pain. So, yes, indeed, that can happen, although it's probably more likely that it's not a primary muscle problem, but it's the nerves that are going to that muscle from the lower back that are inflamed or irritated. The right kind of exercises, physical therapy, maybe yoga, those kind of things could help, but it would be wise to visit a primary care doctor if you've not already done so. Go through an X-ray of the pelvis and lower back to make sure it's not a more serious condition.
All right. Here's another question. This is a little complicated. We'll see how we can do. It's also coming by email from someone who writes that a woman I know has had severe right buttock pain. Was so bad, apparently, for several years now, it's caused her to limp. She was given a diagnosis of piriformis, you know, piriformis syndrome?
Of course.
Of course. And she did stretching exercises for 18 months. When the pain did not resolve, she had X-rays, and that showed severe arthritis in the right hip and is now scheduled for a hip replacement. She is 68. I know another woman who had pain that sounded similar to the first woman and apparently saw you, and you performed a microdiscectomy. And the result was immediate and permanent pain relief. So the question the person was writing here is about the diagnosis. You know, how was it that you made the diagnosis in the person that you saw? And, how was it that you knew that surgery would help?
Interesting question. Piriformis syndrome, I think, is much overdiagnosed. Piriformis syndrome means the sciatic nerve is being irritated as it goes across the piriformis muscle, generally giving butt or proximal thigh pain. Unfortunately, as the caller has already identified, there are a lot of problems that can give you pain in that area. A degenerating disc in the lumbar spine can give you pain there. Sacroiliac joint problems can give you pain there. A fracture of the pelvis can give you pain there. Arthritis in the hip can give you pain there. Prostate cancer might give you pain there. Metastatic cancer could give you pain there. There are just all sorts of possibilities. So I think that when a person comes in with pain in that area, it is worthwhile to do an examination. And if twisting the leg reproduces the symptoms, certainly arthritis in the hip has to be in the differential diagnosis, and a doctor would need to do an X-ray of the hip, even if he or she believed it was piriformis syndrome. The same goes when a person comes in with butt pain. Since I deal with backs, I always check the back. And on the image, probably an MRI of the spine, the person had a herniated disc, and I said this was the cause of the problem. Sometimes when I'm not sure, I send the person for an epidural steroid injection. By coating the nerve with a long-acting cortisone-like drug, that can help for weeks or months. And if the person gets dramatic relief for 4 weeks or more, then I know the bulge of the disc is causing the problem. So, yes, I think piriformis syndrome is overdiagnosed. It's real, but overdiagnosed.
Okay. Well, we're just about the point we have to finish. Any last thing you might like to mention before we end up out of time?
Well, thanks for having me back again. At some point, I'd be happy to talk to you about obesity and the outcomes of surgery. At some point, I'd be happy to talk to you about some of the other new technology things that are happening. And we could talk about the genetics of the back at some point in a little more detail.
Okay, so I guess it's probably worth reinforcing the very thing that we talked about at the beginning, where I said, well, you know, what really are the big contributors to back issues? And you said, well, about half of that is genetic, so you can't control that. But about the other another half ends up things that people can indeed control. Do you get exercise? Do you smoke? And are you maybe around what you would like to have your ideal weight to be? And if you're above that, that might likely be a problem.
That's kind of depressing because it means I have to exercise more, I have to eat less, and I have to give up cigarette smoking if I were a cigarette smoker. The good news is I can still have a beer or two.
All right.
That doesn't affect
the back.
We'll
find something good to be good there. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it. Dr. Jim Harms, he's an orthopedic surgeon with the Carl Spine Institute in Urbana.